Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hey, I'm Dr. Lisa. How you doing? You know me. I'm a self-proclaimed psychotherapist that I've been doing, but I have a lot of experience. I have a lot of experience. So anyway, I just got a phone call from my best friend, Margo, but I put it on silent because I'd rather talk to you guys. And I have a guest on. I have this amazing guest, Robert Galinsky, I'm going to get to him in a minute. There's just too much. He's so multi-talented and complex. I can't even explain it quickly enough to get, but I do have to get, because I got to tell you something. Okay. You listening? Are you having tax problems? Do you have like too much money and you're paying too much taxes? I'm so glad you answered yes, because I've got a great place for you to put your money where you can get a tax deduction, okay? Listen carefully. This is financial advice from Dr. Lisa. Radio Free Brooklyn. If you give money to Radio Free Brooklyn, it's tax deductible. The year is not over, people. The year is not over. But I want to, in all seriousness, honestly, just if one of my listeners just donates and shows the radio station that my show doesn't suck and that they actually give a shit about it enough, that will help me personally. Okay. Do you care about me? Do you care about me? Me personally? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I'm just going to say I'm really grateful for everyone who's ever like supported me in any way in my life, even if they just said hello to me on the subway. I appreciate that. Okay, so to our guest, Robert Galinsky. So Robert is a very, like I said, he's complex. That's why he's here with me, folks. You know, I like them complex. I like my guests complex. But anyway, so he's here with me right now. He's in this room. I'm looking at him right now. We made eye contact right there. We're making eye contact, me and Robert. But here's what I want to, I'm going to try and sum this up. So Robert's been a fixture, I'm going to say, in the East Village for, I moved here, I'm older than him, but since I can remember, since I've lived in the East Village pretty much. And he's an activist. He's a director. He's a writer. He does it all. But the reason he's here, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know why he's here? I'm going to tell you why he's here. Because we have to fucking find out about incarcerated teenagers. Okay. That's pretty much why he's here. Because we do not have enough awareness of incarcerated teenagers. And Robert works with them regularly. He knows a lot about it. He's seen it from the inside for years. So we're going to learn about that from him. But we're also going to find out where his interest came from, stuff like that. And he's also been killing it on these solo plays. So we want to, we want to make sure, we get a chance to find out where he's doing that so we can go see him. But, I could read you this stuff. His work as an artist activist has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, and on The View, NPR, ABC Nightly News, and Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. I added that last one in. So, hi, Robert.
Hi, Lisa.
Can you put that in your bio now?
It's now there. Yes.
No. Don't do that. I want you to do well.
I'll put you next to Geraldo.
Okay. So, how are you? How is that bio? Do you want to add to that?
I think we'll unravel it as we keep talking.
Okay, but did it make sense to you?
Totally, yes. Okay. And actually, thank you. It sounded better than I perceived it originally. So
oh,
thank you.
Well... just give us a really broad stroke, summary of what you're doing with teens now so we can start focusing on your childhood. So what's the programs that you're involved in with incarcerated teens?
I currently am working with my company, Galinsky Coaching, and three other really awesome nonprofits, Literacy for Incarcerated Teens, The Kite Zine, and Prison Rights, W-R-I-T-E-S. And Literacy for Incarcerated Teens has been my strongest advocate for being able to go into facilities and working with young people. Prior to the pandemic, I was going to scores of different facilities and going into the facilities to do the work, including Rikers and upstate, as well. And pandemic hit and I had strong relationships with a lot of these institutions and convinced them, let's do some Zoom. Let's do it on Zoom. It was tough at first because they were afraid. All of these institutions are afraid to bring any kind of camera into the space because they don't want any of the warts that are there to be seen. They don't want people to see what's going on in there. And that,
when you said, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Did you mean warts? Wards?
Warts, W-A-R-T-S, the
okay,
ugly
thank
stuff.
You. Yeah. Okay, good.
And they're very nervous about it because those institutions do have a lot of ugly in them. But I got to say from the beginning, the majority, even at Rikers Island, the majority of the people that are there, the vast majority have heart and soul and love in their hearts. And they are trying to do the best they can for people. There's the ugliness that we hear about, the violence, the drugs and the crimes that we hear about within these institutions. They're aberrant and they're all over the place, but that is not the prevailing energy in almost all of these places.
Wow, that is, and that's not because of funding. That's because people have an inherent goodness in them, right?
You nailed it. Exactly.
Do those kinds of institutions attract people who want to help?
It's a mixture. There are those who want to help. There are those who see a decent hourly wage and some great benefits. And then there are those who are not sure what they want to do and, you know, are trying something different. Mm-hmm. But for the most part.
And then there's evil people who just want to be in that situation.
Right, because they are
evil.
Evil, or their soul has been corrupted in some way through their journey, and they now get to express that nastiness upon others.
I remember an abusive counselor in camp. She probably didn't like kids. You know, it doesn't just happen in prisons. So, and the workshops you do, those are writing or acting or both?
They are based on writing and literacy. They then veer off into any direction that is needed. You know, I will bring in, as a quick example on Zoom, I'll bring in an author, a guest author, to some young ladies who are in a facility in Long Island, and they might start talking about her hair and her nails and how beautiful they look on Zoom, you know. And if that's the conversation that gets going, then we go with it, you know.
So you kind of feel out the situation and bring in other people. You kind of tailor whatever it is to the vibe. You get the vibe.
Exactly.
You start with writing and then you get the vibe and work with that. Okay. I don't want to forget to talk about the two plays that you're involved in right now. So why don't we talk about them right now so we don't forget and it won't interrupt anything once we get into
the
bulk of the conversation.
A very good friend of mine, Mataji Booker, who's in LA, said something like, Galinsky goes where most of us don't want to go. He goes where we're afraid to go, or we turn our faces and eyes away from all the time. And that really, she really nailed it. And I didn't know it. She put it in those words and it was great. And so those two places mostly for me are people who are experiencing homelessness and teenagers primarily who are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Those two groups. And I discovered that teenagers were incarcerated. I thought I knew it all. I still think I do. And about 10 years ago, one of my mentors, Jamal Joseph, said, hey, I'm going up to upstate to go do a high school commencement speech in a boys' prison at a high school graduation. And it blew my mind. I was like, high school commencement in a prison? And I found out that, you know, there's massive numbers of teens being detained. And he went and did the speech, and that's when I reached out to the organization that hired him to do that, and that's Literacy for Incarcerated Teens. And I pitched a workshop to them, and they were like, we don't really do workshops. We do mostly author visits with books and speech, you know, talks. And I said, well, let's give it a shot. It was bumpy. It was rocky, but it worked. And so since then, We've been doing fundraising to continue that work.
Wow.
And liberating the minds and the hearts of young boys and girls who are, I would say, most often not guilty of who they are, but are considered guilty for who they are. You know, they mm-hmm. they.
So you know what? Let's get to the plays.
Okay.
Sorry. So, yeah. I'm sorry. No, I have to do this.
I appreciate it. So one play is called The Bench, A Homeless Love Story. Mm-hmm. It's based on my experiences living with and cohabitating and visiting and researching and befriending people who are experiencing homelessness. It started in New Haven. I was 21 years old. I was disenfranchised with my life, and I started to hear these people talk on the street, and I was mm-hmm. like, wow, this is language is incredible.
So I want to get to the story. So what yeah. tell us really briefly, like, what the play is like.
So The Bench is it was
am I putting pressure on you?
I love it. No, you're guiding me.
I hope so. Are you he's not sweating at all.
No, you're guiding me.
You can totally handle this.
I'll veer off the exit ramp and
okay
and
no I want to get to the, you know, we gotta, I want to get, give us a basic storyline of the play and your role in it.
All right. The Bench is about four homeless men who are all attracted to and or in love with one woman who is also homeless mm-hmm. and or living on the edges. Mm-hmm. And so it's about how these guys, one guy in particular, is so torn up about his love for her that he's screwing up their community and their relationships with each other. And they finally say, dude, address it. And he goes to address it, and by the end of the piece, we see that he and her may have a chance to open up that calloused heart that they have created for themselves.
So are there different actors playing the different homeless people?
Originally, it's a five-character play, and originally I cast it, and we did it with different characters. And then a number of years ago, I watched John Leguizamo doing his stuff, and I was like, I can do that, son of a gun. I was going to write a new piece, and I thought, no, I love this piece. So what's unique about it as well is that it's written in dialogue. I don't do monologue, blackout. Mm. It's characters talking to each other. I do all five characters.
Wow.
And then a sixth character who is me, the narrator, as well. So that's the gist.
This shit has gotten great reviews, too, folks.
Yeah, it has. It's nice.
Okay. And also, before we forget, go to Galindo. If you want to find out more about Robert's work or when it's going to be, you want to go see this. Instagram, Galinsky Now, Galinsky Now, Sky, like Sky, Now. That's his Instagram.
Yeah.
So, so tell us about the other play.
So the other play is my newest one, which is called Everything in New York Goes Bang. And that one is much more autobiographical. That's just basically about, it's a mixture of stories and poems and some characters that talks about me, this suburban white kid. You know, I'm in my late 50s, but I still think of myself as a kid for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about this suburban white kid from this bucolic. Is that the pronunciation?
Bucolic
town, Wethersfield, Connecticut, a little suburb. And it's about coming from there, going into the East Village in my 20s and going, holy cow, Bohemia. Wow, this is amazing. And then the journey now into the jails, prisons, and working with homeless people. So Everything in New York Goes Bang is a little autobiographical and talks about the values of a typical white suburban man in this world and the shifting of those values and the learning through artists in the East Village and that tradition of the East Village, Lower East Side, into now where I am now working with teenagers in wow. detainment.
That sounds awesome. And that has been produced.
Yeah.
I mean, it's produced.
I did it.
Is that a solo show?
It's a solo show. I did it one night so far. It's only been done one night.
Really?
And did it in Hollywood in October, this past October. Got really nice response from an audience. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing the slog of raising some money to create a run here in New York.
Mm-hmm. What's your goal for the venue?
I want to do a 6 to 10 week run in a nice little 60 seat theater. Cherry Lane Theater would be really nice.
Yeah,
that's where I did The Bench
too.
At the Cherry Lane.
So you have a relationship with them.
Yeah.
That's ideal. That's a great theater.
And then ultimately a Netflix, HBO, Apple streaming solo show.
Love it. Love it. Well, you know, guys, he also did this documentary, We Live in Public, with Josh Harris, which is a really famous...
Oh, the love, Josh.
No, it's a really famous documentary about... just give us the one-liner on that.
It's the 90s Silicon Alley scene through the eyes and vision of Josh Harris, who's the internet pioneer not many people have ever heard of, but is really the guy who is predicted everything that we are doing right now.
Yeah, yeah,
everything
it's totally prescient. I mean, I visited the place where, you know, where it was happening. I don't think I made it into the film, but I, you know, was there when they were filming, and it is one of the most radical things that I have experienced in my time in New York City, and that's saying a lot. So what I'm saying is that Robert has gotten some films done. I think that was at Sundance or something.
Yeah, by the way, I'm in it a couple small places. I wasn't a great interview at that point. I didn't know how to do a good interview, so I only got a couple bites
like
in there.
Now.
However, and also I'm not one of the producers. I was in that scene. I was Josh's right hand for a number of years from mid-early 90s okay. to the end of Sudo.com, which was the mm-hmm. company. The film is produced and directed by Andy Timoner, who right now has an amazing film called Last Flight Home, which is getting awards across the globe. Mm-hmm. She's so relevant and always ahead of her time. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I can't, you know, really, it's a really amazing film. We should have a screening of it here somewhere at Pine Box or something. We should do that.
Yeah.
You and Radio Free Brooklyn.
Yeah, and we'll get Josh to come out here. Yeah.
Well, it would be great. Let's do that. Okay, we got that done. So I'm really curious to hear about your childhood. I want to hear about what about your childhood that inspired this connection with people who are way less fortunate living on the edge. And I also, so I want to understand that. And I'm curious, can you just give me a little outline of what your family unit looked like?
Yeah. I have two incredible parents. They both are not with us anymore. But my mom's a Roman Catholic Italian. My father was a Russian Jew, and they married in a time when that wasn't really the thing to do. Mm-hmm. And they both were very considerate to other people and taught us the value of loving other people mm-hmm. and not judging people. Mm. And my father was a number of different things. He was a justice of the peace. He was town council, chairman of the board of education. He owned the local pharmacy. He was a science teacher. He was a math teacher. He was somebody who gave back constantly. I'm one of five boys, so we had a big family, no
wow.
girls. My mom says six boys because of my father. And no one lifted the seat ever, and we always left the bathroom door open.
Okay, poor mother.
Yeah. So
are you in the lineup?
There's three above me and one younger than me.
Oh, so lower, younger.
There were three
younger,
that were like
young middle.
There were three that were 2 years apart, then there was a five-year gap, then me, and then five-year gap in my younger brother, Philip, who I actually do a lot of performing with as well, my younger brother.
Oh, so you're close to, you're
close. We're all close.
You're all close.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And so those values mm-hmm. are, as I've gotten older, I go, oh, gee, that's a lot of why I do what I do. Mm-hmm. I also had a tumultuous few years in my life when I was in junior high school and the beginning of high school, where my father was going through some mental issues, and it was a very volatile space. And I remember looking out the window going, oh, it's beautiful out here. We're right by the forest. We're on a cul-de-sac, you know, and everybody's white picket fence and lawns. But there's hell in my house right now. And there's spontaneous volatility in my house. And as I've gotten older, I know that's what has informed me to mm-hmm. go and mm-hmm. seek younger people who experience something similar to that. That's mm-hmm. out of their control. You know, it's out of their control.
So you were all the kids still at home at that point? Were you all at home?
Two of the oldest brothers were off to college. Mm-hmm.
Was there sharing of rooms and stuff? I'm picturing a
crowded
house.
Yeah, there were
house.
Bunk beds. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like the three older always had their own bedrooms. And then as they moved out, you graduate to your own bedroom.
Yeah. So there were four bedrooms for the kids?
Yeah.
Five bedroom
there
house?
There was one, two, three. There were three bedrooms for the kids.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that. Wow.
Yeah, like I said, it was a big house.
And was a pretty nice.
And it was a nice
school.
Yeah.
Nice.
Typical suburban schools, all very white American, mm-hmm. very white American mm-hmm. suburb.
and not a lot of turmoil up until this point. Is that what I'm getting?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so what changed?
What changed was my father going through some financial difficulties with his business, and then that teamed with an undiagnosed depression and bipolar.
Mm-hmm. And about how old was he?
Maybe in his 50s.
Mm-hmm. Did it have to do with like getting old for like getting retired or any of that?
No, it had to do purely with, there's a long line of mental illness in our family, mm-hmm. on that side of the family. Mm-hmm. So it's just part of the composition of our family, mm-hmm. on that side.
So did he seem, were you surprised by, like, did he seem like an emotionally stable guy until a certain point?
Yeah. And even at that point, he was still a loving guy. I loved him, you know, and I still do. And we've since then made up and had, mm-hmm. our reconciliations. The hard part was, you know, here's this guy who I admire and love and has done so much for me, but here he is doing things that, you know, are, again, just using the word volatile, that were spontaneous and, knee-jerk reaction kind of stuff to me that confused me, but that, mm-hmm. taught me that not everything is what you see, you know, mm-hmm. that's not what
exists.
So
did he start acting out like in an angry way?
Yeah.
And like just out of nowhere, just...
Yeah, I mean, small things that a teenager might do or a preteen might do, mm-hmm. that
so, you... So you lift your clothes in the living room or something.
Yeah.
And then
a note that has to be signed, you know, that by the, from the teacher to bring back the next day.
Right. So what would happen then?
I don't want to characterize my dad as a bad guy because he wasn't, but he had his moments.
Well, we don't think he is.
Okay.
We don't think he is at all.
He wasn't. He's an awesome guy.
No, he sounds like a really beautiful person that had some mental problems were untreated when
exactly.
he was younger.
No, exactly.
He's
and
a
they got resolved
person,
once he addressed them.
And he's living through you and doing really good work.
Thank you.
So there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're not thinking that.
Yeah, so they were violent moments, you know. They were, you know, everybody... Not everybody, but I used to think everybody may have gone through that with their parents. But there are many violent moments, and nothing that, you know, wasn't like tortured. I wasn't locked in a room for days in the window, you know, but just spontaneous back at a head slap. Things like that. A couple things that went a little further than that, definitely left an indelible mark on me and have since given me, I think, an even greater sense of empathy, mm-hmm. for young people who have no way to combat that kind of a thing.
So it sounds like he didn't really have control. It sounds like he would get angry and lose control.
Yeah, it was an impulse.
Is that what it, it wasn't like he was premeditating.
No, there was no premeditating. Yeah.
And how did he react like once the incident happened? Did he ever apologize?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He would? So he'd get really angry
he'd recognize
and then he'd be
it.
Sorry about it?
Yeah, he'd recognize it. Yeah.
And then did he feel bad? That would be awful for him.
Yeah.
As well as you, obviously. So how did the rest of the family react? Like, how did your mom react? How did your brothers react? What happened in the family dynamic? That sounds like
it just was kind of the family for, again, this short window of time.
He didn't pick
and
on you.
As I'm speaking about it, I'm wondering my family listening to this, how they'll feel about me sharing this. But I'm sharing this so that anybody else that experienced something like this or is experiencing something like this is not alone.
Well, I can tell you personally, I experienced something like that. My father wasn't violent, but he had a breakdown in his 60s when I was a teenager. And he wasn't violent. He got very withdrawn, but it's like one of the most dramatic things in my life. So I definitely identify on some level.
You know, this is also a time when that kind of stuff with people was not considered what it is today.
No.
Right?
No, no one knew. It was weird.
You smack your kid to keep him in line and whatever. You know?
Yeah. No, my father totally withdrew, which is a whole other thing. But that... it was very frightening, and it was very out of the blue, and it was very, very, very traumatic. And as a kid, you don't know, you can't separate, you can't see your parents as just people struggling. You don't really, you depend on them, and it's very frightening. I mean, I wasn't hit, but it was very, very frightening.
Yeah, and you depend on them, and you kind of idolize them.
Yeah.
And
well,
well, I did. You know,
maybe
to a degree,
there was a
you know.
Point. I'm sure I did.
Yeah. And they are. They,
yeah, I looked up to my right? dad for sure. For sure. Yeah,
they're the ones with the wisdom and the experience
for
and
sure.
the guidance. So.
But you didn't feel personally picked on. That's what I want to know.
No,
it was spread around. It wasn't personal to you.
I mean, again, it was at a time in his life where I was the teenager doing stupid teenager things. So I was definitely a focus point for
right.
him.
Yeah. Right. Because yeah. You were the older, like your younger brother might have gotten away with more or something.
He might have, but he had his share of
he
it as well.
His share. So what happened with your dad? Like, did that go on for years? Like, how did that affect you?
It went on for a couple of years, only maybe a 2 to 3 year window. Mm-hmm. How did that affect me? It drove me to be not. I think a conformist, you know, it made me act out. It made me self sabotage myself for a long time. It made me abuse myself in different ways for a long time. And until I realized that that's not how I have to be and that I was reacting to mm-hmm. things that had happened to me as a kid. Mm-hmm. And it's, I actually feel like it's probably one of the best things that could have happened to me because otherwise I would be an insurance collector with a necktie and a button-down shirt, or I'd be an accountant, or I'd be a court stenographer, and there's nothing wrong with those things, but I like what I do now, which is to continually search and even flail around this world and in the known and unknown.
So, did anybody, like, how did it, you said it was a couple of years, so what happened? Did you just move out, or what happened? Did your mother start thinking, what's happened to him? What's wrong with him? Or like, how did that all go down?
I don't have memories of that. Mm. I mean, I don't even know where, you know, I don't have memories of that. It all ended when I went to college, mm-hmm. when I left the house. Mm-hmm. It ended maybe a year before that too. But yeah. And then when I was 26, I woke up crying in the middle of a very bad dream and called him up in the middle of the night. So we got to talk. So I went home, my mom made lasagna, and we sat for the whole weekend and ate lasagna at the kitchen table and cried. And I recounted things that happened. And he was like, I did that. Oh my God, I don't remember that. I did that.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah. And then a week later, I got a handwritten letter from him asking for forgiveness and acknowledging it.
Oh man.
And I called him immediately and said, absolutely.
Oh my God.
Absolutely.
Wow. That gave me the chills. That's so beautiful. That's so amazing that you had the wherewithal at that age, which is young, to do that. And that, like, that's such a, to me, sounds ideal. You know what I mean? Like, where you, like, you went there, you made the effort, you went there, and then, you know, you were able to resolve it and your father was able to own it. I mean,
yeah,
that's,
he did.
That's like, that's pretty, that's idyllic
and
to me.
Yeah. And even, even in the tough times, I always loved him, was grateful for everything he had sacrificed for me, even in those mm-hmm. tough times. And it made after this reconciliation, so to speak, or this addressing of it, an even more fruitful relationship.
Mm-hmm. So how did you change at that time, though, as a child, as a teenager? Like, how did you change? You said you did self-discipline.
Class clown.
So were you, like, a really good kid up until then?
I was always a good kid. I'm still a good kid, Lisa.
No, but were you making straight A's or
no,
good student?
I was just
well-behaved?
I was a B student, and I was the funny guy, and that funny guy was the tears of a clown.
Right.
And that's what I was, friendly and amicable to people. I also did my own little version of bullying people at that time, uh-huh. too, you know.
Because you had a little power, you were funny.
Well, because I was
angry
being bullied, I started to turn into a bully sometimes.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but sometimes. There's a couple people that I've since called myself that I went to high school with and said, I am so sorry for the way I treated you, you know. Yeah, so in that time I was...
But were you getting in serious trouble or just acting
stupid
out?
Stupid little
school things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Teacher had you slipped a note to somebody and teacher said, go get it signed, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Things, stupid things. Shit. Yeah.
Okay, nothing too serious.
Yeah, not so breaking the law, breaking the law.
Okay, so let's get you to where you start hanging out with homeless people.
Those were my people because
So what happened? You moved to New York.
It started in New Haven. I was in New Haven.
Just living there.
I went to school at Southern Connecticut State University. Okay. Was studying special education. Mm-hmm. Loved it because, again, I just gravitated toward people in need and people who were peculiar and considered not normal, which is appealing to me in people in the margins, and overheard these people who were living on the street having these incredibly dynamic conversations with each other that could have been conversations you would have in a house at the kitchen table, in a boardroom at a business. Mm-hmm. But here we are out on the street. So my perception at the time was these guys are aliens. They're zombies. There's no attachment to society. And then I sat in and listened and befriended and talked and actually had a few stay in my apartment on very cold nights.
Wow.
Yeah. I ended up living in a basement for about a year of an abandoned restaurant that we had turned into a theater. So, I mean, I was never homeless, but I was, around them and in those kind of spaces. And the richness of their personalities enlightened me to the fact that they're no different than us. And they all have backstories. And that's included in the bench. They're the backstories of these five characters. Mm-hmm. And so you start, like I did, looking at these raving, quote unquote, raving lunatics, and then realize, oh, wait a minute, the guy was a merchant marine and he saved people's lives. Wait a minute, she was a school teacher. This other guy used to be a truck driver. Another guy owned a deli.
So I have to ask this. Did it seem threatening in any way? Were you ever scared?
Oh, yeah.
You were?
Yeah. Oh yeah, but that was also thrilling. When you're in your 20s,
So you're hanging around these homeless people, and are they dangerous?
Yeah.
Like, what would the danger be? Are they drug addicts? Are they violent?
Drugs, both drugs and violence, egos. Mm-hmm.
So there could be you could be hanging out with them, and there might be some, and then all of a sudden somebody gets mad, and it could be some violence of some sort.
And mental illness, right? So I've had knives pulled on me. I've gotten into fights, physical fights, to defend myself.
Mm-hmm. What did you feel your role was there? I mean, you didn't just slip in unnoticed.
My role was, and it still is, like with these kids in jail and prison, is go somewhere that the rest of the world doesn't go, tell the world about it. Again, going back to Jamal Joseph, witness. So I used to go to Rikers. When I went to Rikers, I would come home and I would post about it. Mm. And I called Jamal up one day. I said, I feel guilty. It's like people post their salad. What's what I had for brunch? Which just totally disgusts me the majority of the time. Like, and I'm like, now I'm posting about my experience, like I'm showing off. And he said, you shut up. He goes, you are going to places that not everybody gets to go, and you have a responsibility as a witness to tell us. So that has been the prevailing motif for me, witness. Yeah. And I guess that's what I was doing back then.
Right, and that's what we're doing now. So So do you have any broad generalizations, which are like broad generalizations are bad, but we have a half an hour left, but we don't have nearly enough time to really pull this apart the way it justly should be. But like about homeless, how people become homeless or how teenagers become incarcerated, do you have any broad generalizations or anything?
The broad generalization is we have 7 football stadiums in the United States right now that have cost us over $2 billion each to make. We have spent $2 billion or more on 7 different stadiums. If we would spend a fraction of $2 billion on mental health, on getting people who addressing people who are homeless off the street, addressing violence in the household for these teenagers, we would change this world in 1 year. The ripple effect would be so powerful. We don't have the will. Our culture does not have the will to do anything deeper than create spectacle for distraction.
So and you think it's a funding issue? You think funding it's would
a,
help
It's a
them?
Will. No, the money's there. If taxpayers and private billionaires can put $3 billion together to create a football stadium in Los Angeles that's state of the art.
But what would we
and you
do?
You walk into that stadium and you pass 80 homeless people.
Right, but what would we do as a society? Would we build homes? Would we have like more programs
all
like
those
you're
things,
doing?
Yes,
you think,
all those things.
You think these people could be helped and they're not being helped?
Absolutely. Why do teachers have to buy paper and pencils for their students when we've got a baseball player who's making $240 million dollars for 12 years?
So tell us what it's like with the teens. Tell us, like, how did the teens wind up incarcerated? Tell me, like, what happened, like, what your experience.
Most of the teens, I think, wind up incarcerated because of poverty in their household. And mm-hmm. so their parents do desperate things. They get on drugs. They become, they burglarize. And they do whatever they can to survive. So
right.
That's a ripple effect. Their kids see that mm-hmm. and their kids don't get the same type of mentoring. I've met kids, example, Rikers Island, wonderful woman, Ms. Edie. She no longer is there. A few years ago, she organized a Thanksgiving dinner because she walked into one of the halls and said to the kids, 30 young boys in this room, how many of you have experienced a Thanksgiving dinner? 30 kids, two raised their hands. And one said, my experience has been, I make sure I go to five different friends' houses. So I get five meals and I get to go and, you know, that's the day I go around to different friends' houses where I know I can get good food and family and blah, blah. Another one, their family celebrated it. 28 out of 30 kids had never celebrated Thanksgiving. I know that sounds unbelievable. It is the truth.
No, I believe it. And it's heartbreaking.
So what she did was, okay, here's what we're doing. And this was like a month before Thanksgiving. She organized in the gymnasium at Rikers Island a Thanksgiving dinner for these kids. And she said to me and a number of other teachers that were teaching there, reach out, find volunteers. What we're going to do is set up 20 tables. We're going to bring the kids in shifts. And we set up 20 tables. We're going to get the food. We're going to get the turkey. We're going to set it up like a beautiful Thanksgiving at every table with tablecloths. And I want one volunteer sitting at each table when they walk in, four kids to a table with a volunteer, and you're going to have a Thanksgiving dinner together.
It makes me want to cry.
I know. It was beautiful. And so I told my friends, I had my niece, Jenna, she showed up, a whole bunch of people were like, I am there.
So how did the kids, like, well, how was that for the kids?
It was,
how did
they, it was profound.
Like
there were mm-hmm. There were some tears.
From the children?
Yep. From the volunteers as well.
Yeah.
It was awkward. It was 45-minute shifts so they could get as many kids in to eat. So we ate all day. And she also put on the table a glass with prompts, conversation prompts, just in case
Brilliant.
We didn't know what to say, right? Ms. Linda Edie, amazing woman. And so when they sat down, it was awkward at first.
Sure, of course.
Right? We're sitting with a stranger and you're like looking at each other. This is goofy. But then after a while, within like 5, 10, 15 minutes, we're having these incredible conversations and these warm divulgences to one another. And it was just pure love. It was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful.
You really felt the kids got affected. You could see that.
And if you could extrapolate that kind of love and concept and application and put $2 billion behind it, you can change the world.
Yeah. And those kids are probably so hungry for that.
Oh, totally. And some was so very foreign to them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I can't. It's overwhelming even just to hear about it. I know that sounds ridiculous.
No, it doesn't. Because it absolutely was.
It is. So how do kids wind up getting in prison? And what's it like for them once they're in there?
It's they get in because of the systemic.
I mean, understand about their parent. I mean, they have. It's not that hard to see how they would like wind up doing something to get in jail. And but how do they get in there?
They get in there because there is a great, an incredibly baked in system to keep the machine rolling. So mm-hmm. that, you know, in prison or jail, everything costs money. Somebody's making money. We don't think about it. Cleaning companies, even though there's not a lot of cleaning done, cleaning companies, laundry companies, food
right.
companies,
there's,
delivery
companies,
all
a
that,
business.
Right? So don't disrupt that business, right? Keep the bodies in the beds. Mm. Keep them coming in. And I forgot the original question.
So how do they wind up? Their society wants. I've heard that about drug rehab centers. They try to get. They want to fill the beds, and the people putting the getting the people in there also give them drugs so that they test so they can get in.
Well, you know, also in the jails and prisons that I visited, and again, like I said at the very beginning of this, the overwhelming good is overwhelmingly present, right? Mm-hmm. So, but
how old are the youngest ones?
I've seen 14-year-olds.
14.
Yep.
14 would be the youngest. So what happens? Like the police, do they get caught selling drugs?
Caught selling drugs. There's the kid, Khalif Browder, who you know, was accused of taking a book bag. And, you know, yeah. There's the girls is really terrible because I have no scientific measure, but I would tell you 99% of every young girl I've seen in jail or prison has been molested by a family member or a friend of a family member. There's a young girl who I was talking to. She was 16 and she'd already been in for a year. And she said, "Oh, you live in East Village?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Oh, you know the Bowery Hotel?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah." She goes, "It's really nice, isn't it?" I go, "Yeah." She goes, "They got nice rooms in there, don't they?" I go, "Yeah." And then I'm looking at her going like, "How do you know how they have nice rooms in there?" And so I asked, and she said, "Oh, I've been in those rooms." And she gave me this look like, and I never asked why they're incarcerated.
Yeah, but you
but she gave me this look like my pimp brought me there, basically.
So most of the girls are victims of sexual violence and are prostitutes or
have been prostituted.
I sound like an idiot right there. You're right. It's totally, they're trafficked. That's really the word we need. That's really, and they wind up in jail because they're trafficked.
They broke the law.
No. And I understand that. I hear you. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but I hear you. Let's put it that way.
And what I was describing about myself as a teenager, acting out. But because I'm a white male in this culture, I can act out and be told, don't do that again. But if I'm a brown male in this culture or a brown female in this culture and I act out, I'm going to be paying the price in a legal system.
So are you saying that most all the teenagers you see are of color?
I've been in and out of Rikers Island jail for 9 years. I have probably seen 2,000 people, young people. Out of those 2,000, I'm not exaggerating, I have seen 25 white boys. They're all Latin and black.
I believe you. I'm not surprised.
The females, it's different. The females, it's different because, again, they are abused on a whole nother level by men. So there are, I've seen probably 25% have been
so there's more white
Caucasians.
More white girls. Are the girls, what they've been through seems really, are the girls really different than the boys because they've been through different sorts of?
Yeah, the girls are different because there's a similarity in this sort of bravado, that shield that one has to put up. But the other difference is, you know, as a guy and as a white guy walking in, working with young girls who've been through type of hell, there's a certain trust level that has to be established. And when it does get established, it's awesome. You know,
then we so it's really healing for them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, that's really
good. And it does happen. It does happen.
I have no doubt. So what is life like for them? What is a life?
It's awful. It's terrible.
But what is it? And so, how long are they in there for? Are they in there forever? I mean, do they get out ever?
It depends on
their behavior.
Their behavior. It depends on the bail, the price of the bail that was set. You know, there's some kids, the bail is $5,000. You only need 10% of that $500. But when you come from abject poverty, $500, no one's going to kick that up for you. You can't. Where are you going to find that?
Yeah.
So they have to wait it out. This court system's all backed up and screwy. So there's that weight. Everybody on Rikers Island is innocent until proven guilty. It's a jail. The difference between jail and prison, right?
Right.
There's 10 jails on Rikers Island.
Right. People waiting to get in front of a judge.
Yeah, 10 different buildings, 10 different jails. It's got its own bus system. It's got its own gas station.
And they all have public defender lawyers.
Mostly.
Yep. Yeah.
There's one facility where when you are sentenced, you might get put into that building and then, you know, you get released
to a different, to a prison.
No, when you're, yes, either to a prison, and or you're released.
You're released free. So some of them could be there for years.
Yeah.
So what is life like? Like, what happens? Do they sleep in dorms? I want people to understand. Yeah. Like, I want to know what life is like for them.
So I'll tell you, you get on a bus and you go in this long bridge, which is one way in and one way out. That's the only way to Rikers Island. There's no subway. There's no extra roads in. There's one road in and one road out. So that's kind of ominous. You get in, you get off that bus, you go through the main checkpoint, metal detectors and IDs. Great. And then you get on another bus, one of the buses that will go to take you to, that does different stops at different buildings.
Facilities,
right?
Yeah.
And so then if you get out of that next bus, again, metal detectors, IDs, and now you are, if at a certain point you can earn the right to not be escorted. You've been there long enough. So at some points I'm not escorted.
Oh,
I have a pass where I can walk through. And then sometimes depending.
But are they all living in the same, like they're not allowed to leave their building. I want to hear are they indoors?
Right. So now you walk into this building and now you walk down a long corridor and every 40 meters, there's another gate that you go through. So there's multiple gates, big steel, traditional, what do you call it? Cliche heavy doors, you know?
Yeah, like on TV.
Really disgusting painted years of paint and goop and whatnot. And to your left and right down these long corridors, which could be two football fields long, there are left and right doors to different wings, if you will. Mm-hmm. And you'll bang on a door. You'll bang on this big heavy metal door. And then somebody who's in what they call the bubble, which is where the officers, the command station is, will come and open the door for you or click a button. You go through that door, another heavy door. You go through that door. And now you walk in and there's a quote unquote day room, which is just a cement floor with metal tables that are welded or bolted to the floor. Mm. And it's drab. It's gray. It's dark. There are maybe two monitors, TV monitors behind plexiglass that are playing, of course, Law and Order all freaking day, because why not keep watching crime and victims and watching, you know, authorities bust people?
Are the kids interested in that?
Of course.
They relate
that's
to
their
that.
Thing.
That's their life.
And so that's the main room. And then there's another corridor within that if you took a right instead of a left to the main room, there's this long corridor, which has cells left and right, left and right, left and right. It's not like Orange is the New Black. It's not that's so fake.
Made for TV.
It's crazy. So if you walked into one of those rooms, cells, first of all, there's another steel door with a little slot that you could slide food through. Oh. Or a small window that's plexiglass and is all muddied up and you can't even see through. There's a slit of a window in the cell itself. There's a bed bolted to the floor and a couple shelves. And that's where your teen lives. That's where your kid lives.
So each teen has their own space.
Not necessarily, because there's another place that facility where you walk in and it's like a barracks.
Right.
So you walk into this one, you go through all those gates and all that jazz, and you walk in, it's a big room, and it's cots bolted to the floor, maybe 10 on the left and 10 on the right, and you get a plastic bin, and all your belongings are in that bin next to your bed, and there's no division between each other. So you hear the farts and the snores and the crying nightmares from the person in the same giant hall that you're in.
No, it's terrible. So are those must be like people who aren't violent.
No, that's not the case.
No.
There's no rhyme or reason. There's no rhyme or reason. And again, like if you stole a book bag, you could be next to the guy who's accused of rape or murder.
Right. And so are people, imagine that people would be fighting in those.
Lots of times I've been turned away because, you know, I'll get through all the gates and then they'll say, I'm sorry, you can't come in today. Somebody got slashed yesterday, 160 stitches from his ear to his belly button. Mm.
Do you see people who've been beaten up?
I've seen being beaten up and being maced. I've seen people being jumped. It's not common while I'm there for whatever reason, but I've seen it.
It happens. So tell us about, like, so what do the kids, I mean, like, what do they talk about? What do they eat? Like, how do they eat?
Eat! Oh, my God. So on some days, there'll be a, you know, those rectangular metal pans that they use in restaurants that are on those, or in cafeterias.
Yeah.
Some days I've been in there and I'll walk in and there's a metal pan filled with about 10 pounds of gray tuna and then two loaves of bread that have been sitting there. Some days I'll walk in and they'll bring in the food late and the kids will, it'll be 26 hot dogs. And there's 14 kids. They go.
Are they hungry a lot?
They're starving. They grab three, four hot dogs at a time. Some kids grab six so they could share them because they have heart. And again, the staff is not truly responsible for this chaos and mayhem.
I understand
they empathize
that. I understand.
For the majority of them. They
I
empathize.
I understand that. Are the kids hungry a lot?
Yeah, they're hungry. They also complain. They're kids. This chicken is terrible, man. This, right?
Yeah,
and I've eaten with them. You know, I've eaten with them, and I use their bathrooms. And they're always like, "What the hell are you doing that for, man? There's a staff bathroom over there."
Yeah, I'm
like, dudes, if it's good enough for you, if it's bad enough for you, it's bad enough for me.
Is the bathroom okay?
No, it's disgusting.
Disgusting. And who cleans it? Are they supposed to clean it themselves?
If there's programs set up, if they clean it themselves, they earn points. They get more time with television or, you know, certain recreation time. They can up their rec time. But they're gross, the bathrooms.
Are there any, there's no phones, I'm guessing.
That's interesting. There are phones. They changed that law a few years ago. Because they used to, again, the phone company was making tons of money, these private phone companies, because they charge them $6 a fucking, excuse me.
You're allowed to say fuck.
Okay. That was the first
fucking
swear.
A.
Wow, it's been 50 minutes
I'm pretty good.
We
only have 8 minutes left.
I did good. I only swore in the final 8 minutes. Now they get phone time and they are in, that is in that main room in some of the spaces. So there is some relief to be able to call people.
That's good to hear. So what's the headspace of these kids like? What do they talk about? How do they get along? Do they form relationships? Do they hope to see their parents again?
It's all of that, right? So most of the conversation is around money, hip hop. Most of the conversation is around territory. A lot of the conversation is around rehabilitating themselves.
Do they want to do that?
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah. Definitely.
Oh, that's great.
There's a lot of I want to change my life. It's hard to change your life, though, when you get released back into the very place that groomed you to be in prison in the first place.
Of course. So, but you see that.
Yeah, totally.
And if
the human heart is pounding in these places. It wants love. It wants beauty.
Do they form, like, relationships?
Yeah.
Good relationships?
They form really good relationships.
They look out for each other
and take care of each other.
Oh.
There was a case where I was there one day and everybody was crowded around this one guy. They were all listening to him so intently. And so I came over and they all shut up. He shut up and I go, "What's up?" He goes, "Come on, man. I ain't sharing this with you." I said, "Come on, man. You know who I am, right? Come on. I've been here for weeks." And he's like, "We got a new guy coming in. I'm letting these guys know we're not going to cause beef with this guy. Because that's just going to screw us up. That's going to make us lose time with recreation, outdoor time. And so I'm setting these guys straight that when this guy shows up, you want to kick his ass, you want to be a tough guy, don't do it because you're going to mess it up for everybody." So there is beautiful,
like,
communication going on at times.
Is there any dating? Do the boys and girls see each other?
No, they don't. They're in different buildings.
Oh,
they never see each other.
Wow. Are they lonely? I mean, or like what, or do they just take, do they kind of fall into a life there? Or
they're absolute,
do they get depressed?
Totally.
Are they depressed?
They're depressed. They're given medication. I don't know how that's facilitated, how clearly that's diagnosed. There was a kid who's, you know, was in there and his mother died and they wouldn't let him out to go see his 17-year-old kid.
Painful.
Couldn't go out to see his mom die or be at her funeral, you know. So they go through a lot. There's a kid, another bunch of kids. Oh, I just turned 16. Another kid was like, "I'm 18 and I'm here on my 18th birthday. I can't believe this," you know. And another one, I came in on, I think it was Father's Day once. I think it was Father's Day. And they're like, "What you doing in here on Father's Day?" You know, and I'm like, "Somebody needs you, right? I need you and you need me." And I like to go in on Sundays and on holidays because that's when there's the least amount of activity and it's the best time to bring some activity.
So how do the, like, how do you, I know you must have a huge impact on the kids, but like how, what is that? Like, how do you impact them? How do you connect with them? Like, what goes on there?
Well, I
we have 5 minutes. Sure.
There's a short comment in my show, Everything in New York Goes Bang, where I said to a kid, all right, man, we had a great day, blah, blah, blah. I said, I'll see you next week. He's like, okay, cool. I come back next week. He looks at me and goes, oh shit, you showed up. I go, what do you mean? You came back. I go, yeah. He goes, I said I was coming back. He goes, everybody says they're coming back. Nobody comes back.
Wow.
So just coming back, just showing up is super powerful.
Wow. And they are really grateful kids.
Totally.
Yeah, yes. which is something that is such an important...
They've been demonized. They've been demonized.
So,
and, you know.
So what do you think happens to them when they get... do you ever hear what happens to them or when they get released? Have you seen them get released? Like, do you know anybody who's gotten released?
Oh, yeah. One of my students, I worked with her for about a year inside. And then when she was inside, she was like, I want to do a TED Talk. And when she came out, we worked for another 6 months. She got a TED Talk.
Yeah, because you do TED Talks with teens.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where are those? Are those on the TED?
TEDx, this one's on TEDx Fulton Street.
Right, right. So you can find it.
Mm-hmm. There's another, I didn't work with this guy, but I was sending books upstate and I went to FedEx and I said, is there any kind of discount you can give for me sending these to upstate to kids in jail? He goes, you are? I go, yeah. He goes, he did some magic hocus pocus and he goes, I used to be in that facility. So it, like an $80 FedEx turned into a $12 FedEx. And I was like, man, good for you. Look at you,
wow,
right?
Wow. So have you seen the girl that did the TEDx?
Yeah.
So
she's we're in touch all the time.
And what does she do now?
She's got a job at a restaurant. And I do a monthly poetry event at Book Club Bar in the East Village. Mm-hmm. Third Thursday of every month, she comes. Shows up. I said, look, if you can get here, I'll pay for your Uber home. So she shows up, she kicks a piece, or she'll come and just be around it and be in, you know, in the room, and then she goes home.
So you're doing like writing workshops?
Oh, primarily.
Is that how it starts?
That's the essence of it, yeah.
Yeah, and what kind, you just to get them to express themselves, express their feelings?
Yeah, and then create something out of that pain that brings value to them and other people in the world.
So that must be pretty profound to hear those young people putting their pain into words.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that like really?
Yeah. It really is.
And and that must be so helpful and healing, right?
Totally.
To hear, for them to be able to do that, right?
Yeah, they're working through stuff. You know, we all do it in different ways, right? So, you know, and like I said, it doesn't matter if they're talking about somebody's incredible manicure.
Yeah.
That gives them a sense of normalcy. They're not again being told, you're wrong. One of the first things I say when I walk into a room is, I don't want you to think any of you are wrong. Not anybody in this room is, nobody in this room is wrong. And they all look at me like, this guy's nuts. We've been told we're wrong all our lives. I'm like, no, you are not wrong. Everybody has done something stupid or has gotten caught for something. You're not wrong. So let's start from there, okay? And it shifts immediately. Like, this guy is not like the rest of them.
Wow. 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 So we have 1 minute left. Is there anything that you would like us to know that you can speak, that you can impart on behalf of, you know, what you're doing or the people
that
you
represent?
The last
thing I'll say, yeah, I mean, two things is one, not everything is what you think it is, right? That's clear. Like these,
they're not in there for the reasons you think, and like what their lives are like are not what you think.
Right. And they may have done something wrong, but there are reasons, deep reasons behind that most often.
Right.
And they still need to be held accountable.
Right.
But not to the level of this mental anguish and torture.
Right.
The other thing is librarians are tough mofos. I work with Literacy for Incarcerated Teens. It's a group of incredible retired librarians, and they are badasses.
Okay, shout out to librarians. Thank you so much for being